Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The problem with Rio. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Among the concerns about the Summer Olympics in Brazil, which begin in earnest this weekend, are the Zika virus and water quality, but also on the list, kidnappings and terrorism.
As you strike things off your to-do list this weekend, you'll notice how low gas prices have fallen. How much further will they drop?
Record crowds are showing up to America's national parks. Find out the two well-known parks struggling with cramped buses and long bathroom lines.
And with the presidential debates conflicting with NFL games on two occasions this fall, why not save everybody the agonizing choice of which to watch and just combine them?
Who really needs to watch highlights at halftime? Bring the candidates out, have them talk. I mean, you even have some time for Gary Johnson and Jill Stein at that point. I mean, why not combine the incredible circus of a presidential campaign with the most significant circus in American life, which is NFL football?
Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay on how to merge the debates with football games. He's here later in the hour. It would be an understatement to say it hasn't been a smooth ride for officials prepping for the Rio Olympics. Some athletes, media members, and visitors have been advised to stay away from Rio. Many have, but the games will go forward nonetheless. As you settle in to watch some of Team USA, perhaps, over the weekend, Karim Zidane at Sports on Earth has a look at several of the concerns still lingering. Karim, give us a summary.
Let's start basically with the political tension that's going on. To put it simply, Brazil is basically dealing with a president in the process of impeachment, an oil-related scandal, and protests around the country. Now, while the protests have decreased slightly ahead of the Olympic Games, it doesn't change much of what's actually going on. It's based on something called the Petrobras scandal. And this scandal involves the state-controlled multinational corporation in the petroleum industry that created a cartel, a secretive cartel here, that purposely inflated the worth of Petrobras contracts. So in this process, they've bribed politicians to allow this perpetual cycle of corruption to go up, and they've inflated prices in the petroleum market.
Wow.
Now, that's just one of the things. This is also added, of course, to the economic turmoil in the country. Brazil's in a deep recession right now, which is not the case 7 years ago. 7 years ago, it was a flourishing economy that many people looked to as the example to set for other developing nations. But that's not the case right now. The GDP dropped by 3.8% in 2015, and it's expected to head in the same direction by the end of this year. All signs show that it's going to drop by even more or by exactly the same amount, which is terrible considering all the tourism that's supposed to be coming in with the Olympics. So this, together with rising unemployment rates and political upheaval, reached a boiling point heading into Rio. So street robberies have increased in that time, kidnappings have increased, and this is a major concern for athletes who are going to be there. Now, there's 85,000 security officials, that's the number that I've been told, that are going to be around the Rio.
Right.
But that does not consider the fact that there has been a budget decrease for security over that time. They're struggling so much right now with resources and with their economic concern that they've actually removed a significant portion of the budget, about one-fifth of the total budget for security, which is $550 million less they are going to spend on security at the Rio Olympics. Now, that's something that should terrify all the tourists that are going, the athletes that are there, and journalists. Let's not forget the media who are also going to be there. So all those elements together don't make for a very safe Olympics, in my mind. And Rio de Janeiro was never one of the safest cities in the world in the first place.
Yeah. We're speaking with Karim Zidane, columnist at Sports on Earth, and we're talking about his story entitled The Shadows Over Rio. Back up for just a second and explain something you mentioned earlier about the increase in kidnappings. What's happening and what are the reasons for these?
Kidnappings generally were done because it was a way for street thugs to get sort of ransoms from wealthier individuals in the country. And that's exactly what we've seen in this story as well, because it was the Formula One billionaire boss, his wife's mother, who was kidnapped this past weekend or this past week. And it was a whole story for the entire week until they were finally able to recover her just a few days ago. And it's a major concern. Now, while this occurred in Sao Paulo, this adds to my issue, the troubling issue that with a lack of security in Rio de Janeiro, this is not exactly a safe time to be doing anything in Rio. There's going to be a lot of very important people present in these cities, whether it be athletes that are worth a ransom, whether it's going to be various tourists coming in. Certainly, a lot of them will have money, which is why they're able to travel to and fro. It's a privilege at the end of the day to be able to attend these sort of events. Mm-hmm. And with the sort of recession and the hardship we're seeing right now with the unemployment rate, it's almost too easy an opportunity for a lot of thugs who are going to be around in the areas at the time. So it's definitely something to worry about, especially that it's known that kidnappings are done with a key interest in ransoms. They're usually let go almost unharmed if the ransom is handed. Now, in this case specifically, the police actually have, the police in Brazil have very specific kidnapping divisions set up. This is how common these things are. So the kidnapping division asked for the Formula One boss to stay where he is and not to move, not to come to Brazil, and they were able to retrieve his mother-in-law on their own in the end.
Boy, you know,
so that, at least that situation ended well.
Oh boy, if Brazilian authorities can't get a handle on kidnappings, for example, how are they going to defend against potential terrorism threats?
Well, that's exactly the sort of question that everyone's asking right now. We're talking about 85,000 security officials. Is that really enough to handle a tournament of this magnitude, of this size? I mean, Russia offered more security in the 2014 Sochi Games. In winter, and I mean, you have to look at it relatively. Brazil should have been capable of doing all this. When Brazil was handed the Olympic Games, was told that they were going to be the host nation, we were looking at a very, very different environment, and it's just very disappointing to see how it has turned out 7 years later.
Thanks, Kareem. Kareem Zidane from Sports on Earth. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Need a website? Why not do it yourself with Wix.com? No matter what business you're in, Wix.com has something for you. Used by more than 84 million people worldwide, Wix.com makes it easy to get your website live today. You need to get the word out about your business. It all starts with a stunning website. With hundreds of designer-made, customizable templates to choose from, and the drag-and-drop editor, there is no coding needed. You don't need to be a programmer or designer to create something beautiful. You can do it yourself with Wix.com. Wix.com empowers business owners to create their own professional websites every day. When you're running your own business, you're bound to be busy. Too busy. Too busy worrying about your budget. Too busy scheduling appointments. Too busy to build a website for your business. And because you're too busy, it has to be easy. And that's where Wix.com comes in. With Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com to create your own website today. The result is stunning. Little has united presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump over the past year, but they could have supported each other through difficult campaign logo rollouts. It's a story from Sam Schwartz, editorial fellow at National Journal. He's got a behind-the-scenes look at the design of logos and their importance. Sam, what about the logos?
So the Hillary Clinton logo was unveiled over a year ago now, and when it first came out, it was pretty widely panned. It was, the arrow was facing to the right, and it was red, so everyone was basically saying this is a conservative logo.
Right.
Is she saying that she's going to be moving to the right, or is she saying more center, kind of, is she abandoning the left? And then as time went on, it became adapted, and so, for example, for LGBT Pride, they turned the arrow, and they made it a rainbow flag, and so the fact that it was very adaptable kind of helped it, and also the fact that it was perfectly sized to fit like a Facebook profile picture, a Twitter cover photo, things like that, helped it a lot. And so I think it was kind of over time accepted, and now it's been pretty widely applauded.
Got it.
So the Trump logo at first was pretty simple. His slogan, Make America Great Again, was prominently featured, and his name. That was it. And then when they picked Pence, it's kind of when everything went south, because it seemed kind of like they rushed the process a little bit. And so the T and the P were monogrammed in a way that raised some eyebrows, you could say, both for the way the T intersected the P and for the kind of thought of toilet paper that people had when they looked at it.
Right. So just thinking out loud here then, if the Trump campaign had given it time, would it have stuck the way the Clinton campaign logo did? Because sometimes, you know, you can have a knee-jerk reaction and change things when, in fact, I don't know, a day or two may have gone by, it would have blown over. I don't know what the approach was.
So I think they made the right move abandoning it, because the Hillary campaign's logo was panned because it was kind of new and the rightward facing arrow, whereas the Trump campaign's logo was kind of sexualized. I don't know a better way to say that.
Yeah, okay.
And so I think that would have been the discussion, and I don't think it would have been one as easily abandoned as an arrow.
Right.
So I think by just abandoning it, sticking with Trump, Pence, the names, and Make America Great Again, they simplified it. It tells their campaign story. That's all they needed.
Yeah. All right, and so on the Hillary Clinton side, too, this was adaptable also to include Senator Tim Kaine on signage and logos as well?
So it was a little bit tricky for sure because it was the H with the arrow. And so instead of just having the H with the arrow, they included Kaine in some way. I think the way that they did it was they were prepared in advance for... So if you in the story, I talked about how USA Today reported that they had mocked up 16 different logos with first names and last names of multiple potential campaign running mates, whereas the Trump camp didn't do that. And so they were prepared for the situation, and it was adaptable because they had thought through all the kinks and they realized this is what they could do.
Mm. We're speaking with Sam Schwartz, editorial fellow at National Journal. He's got an interesting piece entitled The Do's and Don'ts of Political Logos. Any other candidates get panned early on, say, in primary season for their logos?
So there was some talk about Jeb Bush's logo. It was just Jed with the exclamation point. People were talking about how he was, like, screaming at you or trying to make you enthused when he, as a candidate, wasn't necessarily as enthusiastic.
Oh, right.
And so that was interesting. Even though it was the same logo he used in his 1994 gubernatorial race, I think the fact that it was on a widespread national scale, people kind of laughed at it and mocked him about it. And then Scott Walker also had some issues because he made the E in his name into the American flag, and the E with the American flag was the same as a logo for a national eyeglass company. And so he had some public issue with that when they called him out for it.
Holy cow. I know that there was one person you talked to in your story who talked about the two cardinal sins when it comes to logo design. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So the first one was on a serious note. He said, never do anything without preparing. And I think that was a shot at the Trump-Pence logo, how it was rushed and how... Because it seems like the way it was done was Pence... Trump wasn't sure that Pence was going to be his pick until about 10 minutes before he tweeted it out. That's kind of how it's been reported.
Right.
And so it's pretty clear that they weren't prepared for everything that was going to happen. And so the Hillary campaign, on the other hand, was very prepared. And so I think the parallels between that and the differences in the campaigns kind of... That was number one. And then number two, he said never use Comic Sans.
Sam Schwartz, editorial fellow at National Journal. Never use Comic Sans as your font. 22 minutes now after the hour. NASCAR is in Watkins Glen, New York this weekend. Kyle Busch, who ran out of fuel on the final lap at Pocono last week, has five races now to crack the top 30 to become eligible for the chase for the NASCAR Sprint Cup. But that's not the only thing that occupies his life these days. He and his wife Samantha have a one-year-old and are also figuring out ways to strike the work-life balance just like the rest of us. As part of that, they pedal Snickers, of course, which is the car he'll be racing this weekend. And they're both here now. Kyle, explain the hectic schedule.
It's quite busy. You know, certainly some weekends we know where we're going to be. Well, all weekends we know where we're going to be at, but I guess we don't know how long we're going to be there. I say that because this past weekend at Pocono, Pennsylvania, we actually got rained out on Sunday, had to stay till Monday. We raced yesterday. Finally got the race out of the way, but we got home late last night. And again, we already leave on Thursday morning to head on up to Watkins Glen and get ready for our Snickers Crisper race car here this weekend.
Is that what it's typically like? You might be home for like a day or two or a matter of hours and you just back out the door?
Some days. You know, last week, actually, I wasn't even home at all. We got done racing at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and we went on an appearance on Monday, and then again Tuesday, Wednesday, I was testing at Watkins Glen, and then I had another appearance on Thursday in Hackettstown, New Jersey, and then on to Pocono. So I never got a chance to go home. So it's a good thing I got my wife, who's the rock, and being able to take care of Brexton while they were at home, and they were able to come back up and see me again this weekend.
Very good. So explain what you're up to, too, with the Kyle Busch Foundation and the Bundle of Joy Fund.
So Kyle and I tried for quite a while to conceive, and we ended up having to go through in vitro fertilization to have Brexton. And through going through that process and seeing, you know, how difficult it was and also the financial cost of it, we decided that we would start a fund, the Bundle of Joy Fund, and help couples in the Charlotte area pay for them to go through IVF. And to date, we've helped 13 families, and we continue to raise money and hope to help many more in the future.
That's very good. So what does a family do? Do they apply, or do you find these families through the fund somehow and local, hospitals?
No, they apply through the clinic, the Reach Clinic in Charlotte, where we went through, and there's a big application process, and then twice a year we hand out grants.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
So tell me about the season, I guess, and particularly like what your week is like in terms of staying fit. Do you have to do some sort of workout routine in order to, I don't know, be able to survive in a car for hours on end on a Sunday?
Well, I think being a race car driver, you actually get sort of self-trained, let's say, and you just kind of get used to it. I remember when I was a rookie and coming up through the ranks that there were some times where it was really, really hot, or I may have gotten tired or kind of wore out in the middle of a race. But over time, I've gotten used to the longer events and even running sometimes two or three events throughout a weekend in all three of NASCAR series that I can pretty much withstand all of it. But, being able to have the opportunity and race each and every weekend, it's fun for me. I enjoy it. I love it. And, working out a little bit here or there during the week, of course, that I try to get as much in as I can. Samantha's obviously a huge workout enthusiast,
yeah.
So she gets her fair share in. But, from there, we just try to do what we can.
Yeah, and I love the Snickers Crisper on your car this weekend. They're less than 100 calories a piece, and there's two in the pack, so one for me, one for him. And it keeps him going and me all on our crazy race weekend.
That just means, though, that on family road trips, Kyle will never stop driving as long as you have that kind of fuel in the car, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I can't imagine what it's like to drive with you, though. Are you an aggressive driver, like just out on the regular streets and highways, or can you turn it off?
He's not the aggressive driver at all. If anything, I would say I am. He's a good driver, but he never lets me drive. Honestly, he'll run 500 miles at Bristol and then drive us 3 hours home after he hates my driving. So,
could you imagine? Drives 500 miles at Bristol, gets out of the car, takes a shower or whatever, collects the family, gets back in the car and drives home. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Looking for the next place to grow or expand your business? Why not look to a state that's one of America's top 10 for business, where 2,000 burdensome regulations were eliminated over the past 5 years and is now home to the sixth best entrepreneurial climate. All this and more awaits you in the state of Michigan, the state that should be the number one choice for your business. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. Again, that's MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. The national average price for a gallon of gas is fallen to about $2.12. It's comfortably under $2 where I am here in central New Jersey. What gives, and how long can this latest round of cheap gas stay with us? We're joined now by Tom Kloza, Global Head of Energy Analysis at Oil Price Information Service. Tom, how do you see things?
Oil prices are really in trouble. They're in trouble not necessarily for the long haul. They'll be higher a year or 2 years from now. But for the next few months, we'll probably see refinery run cuts, and the glut kind of comes back, almost like a Freddy Krueger movie. So that's sending gasoline prices down, in most cases, to the lowest numbers we've seen for August in 12 years.
Man, I thought I saw a headline, too, that said road trips are up this summer. That, to the simpleton like me that says demand is up. Well, so why aren't prices up?
Demand is higher, but it's not really higher by all that much. I mean, if you live in New Jersey like I do or some other places out east, there's kind of a maximum congestion, and I think we've seen that this summer. The other thing is that young people aren't driving as much, and people who are driving, even if they trade in their old Suburban, they're tending to get a car that gets better mileage. So I think that demand is up, but it's up about 1% or so, and supply is up by many, many times that, and that's the problem. There's too much supply.
Oh, all right, so that's interesting because you mentioned that young people aren't driving as much, right? They don't feel the same need or desire for a car. right? I mean, is that ultimately going to play a role here?
Well, we don't know ultimately what's going to happen, but we do know that people don't sort of race to get the driver's license when they're 15, 16, or 17 like they used to. The rate of them getting their driver's license is slower than it's been in our lifetime. Now, whether or not that's just a midpoint or whether it's a real trend change, we're not sure. But they do use Uber and Lyft, and there's a lot of folks migrating to the cities. So definitely not the same sort of percentages of people coming into the motor pool and driving, let's say, 12 or 15,000 miles a year.
Mm. I know you said fairly recently, I think it was on a TV appearance, that oil prices are entering like this bizarro world. What did you mean by that?
Well, it is a bizarro world. I mean, it's very odd to see prices drop when you have record demand. I mean, it is record demand, even though it's only about a 1% or so increase. And it's very, very strange to see them drop in July and August. And the strangest thing of all is that the wholesale price for gasoline, which is highest in the United States versus all other countries. You know, other countries are much, much more expensive because of taxes. But the cheapest place to buy gasoline in the United States now in terms of the spot market is California. So it's very, very odd. California is actually going to probably visit some of the lowest prices they've seen since 2003, and they've seen prices drop to where they're about $1.10 lower than they were a year ago.
No kidding. We're speaking with Tom Kloza, Global Head of Energy Analysis at Oil Price Information Service. We're talking about the recent drop in gasoline prices. All right, so what do things look like, say, for the rest of the summer, heading into Labor Day, maybe early fall?
Rest of the summer and really the rest of the year is very, very sloppy prices, and sloppy in this business means weak. We may not match some of the lows that we saw in January and February, but we'll probably see the lowest autumn prices that we've seen since, let's say, 2004. Very cheap diesel, very cheap heating oil, very cheap jet fuel, although it doesn't seem to impact how much space I get when I fly. And then I think it changes next year, and it changes very, very gradually. I would compare this to purgatory. This is a long purgatory that oil has earned after basically climbing to some of the highest levels ever seen for a glut.
Thanks, Tom. Tom Kloza, Global Head of Energy Analysis at Oil Price Information Service in New Jersey. 21 minutes now before the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Here's something to consider when watching the women's gymnastics at the Rio Olympics. The equipment the athletes use these days is a lot different from decades ago. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Women's gymnastics, one of the favorite sports in the Summer Olympics, has come a long way since 1948, the first time the U.S. won an Olympic medal in gymnastics. Louise Radnofsky of the Wall Street Journal has taken a look at some of the changes over the decades and has more. Louise, what kind of equipment did the women compete on in 1948?
Well, the beam that they were using really more closely resembles an actual wooden beam than the kind of padded and beveled equipment that they use today. For the floor, there was a thin covering over grass or wood marked by tape, none of the springy mats that now some of the most aggressive tumbling is performed on. And most peculiarly, perhaps to modernize, the women actually competed on rings. Rings is a piece of equipment the men use and have used for decades, but back then they were competing on it too.
Louise, how have the routines changed and evolved?
With the more modern equipment, it's certainly possible to do different, more athletic things and do them more safely. So the women were not doing that back in the day. Instead, they stuck to what they could do safely, although in some cases it didn't even sound that safe. For example, on the rings, the women would do a back layout to dismount, and as our gymnast, who's still alive from the 1948 Games, reminded us, you could probably break your neck if you didn't do that carefully.
Yeah, I would imagine. I would imagine these women were not training starting at the age of three and competing 24/7 like they do today.
They did start very early in some cases. Many of the women of the 1948 team had Czech or German ancestry and were members of clubs, similar communities along the East Coast, with parents who've been involved in something for gym at early ages. But certainly the training schedule of 8 hours a day that modern gymnasts do makes them almost wince when they think about it. For them, it was very different. They had ages, and they would squeeze in 3 hours a day, maybe, for the games after work.
We're speaking with Louise Radnofsky of the Wall Street Journal about the way gymnastics has changed for women over the years. And I understand from your story, some of the competitions were actually held outside.
They were. The 1948 Olympic Games competition was supposed to have been held outside, but as a Londoner, I can well imagine that the rains got in the way. And they eventually scrambled for an indoor venue and moved the whole thing inside. And it's pretty much been inside ever since the competition. But this was believed to be one of the first, if not the first, indoor competition.
Now, did people pay attention to the gymnastics like they do today? Certainly the media coverage wasn't the same, but was the world aware of this was going on?
The media coverage seemed to focus on the women as sort of glamorous sideshows in the games, and a lot of the headlines at the time feel very quaint now, fragile but agile. It was just really an opportunity to run some pretty pictures rather than focus on the sport. In the full official video of the 1948 Olympics, women's gymnastics doesn't really get a look in at all. There's a tiny bit of men's gymnastics footage, and that was really considered to be, if either of the two sports got any attention, the one that people were tuning in for.
That's the Wall Street Journal's Louise Radnofsky with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. Two of the three scheduled presidential debates between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton this fall will clash on primetime television against the NFL. One night, it's the Falcons and Saints, and on the other debate night, it's the Packers and Giants. With the potential for hard-hitting, drama, and fireworks in both, which spectacle will you watch? Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay has a solution. Merge them. Jason, set this up.
We have a big conflict on the schedule between two of the three debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and America's true national pastime, football. Specifically, one of the debates conflicts with Monday Night Football, and then one a couple weeks later conflicts with Sunday Night Football. Packers and Giants, Gordon, that's a good game. And so there's a little bit of upset in the campaign ranks about this. And in particular, Donald Trump has expressed his displeasure of going up head-to-head against football. You know, Trump, I don't know if you know this, Gordon, but Trump knows a lot about TV, so he says. So he's not thrilled about the prospect of going up against America's premier entertainment brand.
Yes. All right, so your idea is to actually have the debates during the football game on the field during some downtime. So take us through how this would work.
Yeah, well, listen, we're missing a very creative opportunity here, Gordon, are we not? I mean, everybody knows that football has a lot of downtime. I mean, a tremendous amount of downtime. A few years ago, the Journal did a study. There's only 11 minutes of actual football action during a standard NFL game. So if you have all these interruptions, if you have all these breaks, why not just jam in some debate questions? Why not just wheel Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton out? They can get one of those football carts. They can personalize it if they want. Bring them out to midfield during an extended delay, maybe during one of those, you know, just, you know, incredibly interminable instant replay breaks, and have them talk about foreign policy or whatnot. I think this is a real opportunity for a showcase unlike any other, Gordon.
I think it's brilliant. Halftime show, too, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, who really needs to watch highlights at halftime? I mean, again, just bring the debate, bring the candidates out, have them talk. I mean, you even have some time for Gary Johnson and Jill Stein at that point. I mean, there's so much downtime during NFL football, Gordon, and why not combine the incredible circus of a presidential campaign with the most significant circus in American life, which is NFL football.
Would football talk be allowed between the candidates during the game?
Right. I mean, what an opportunity there to have the candidates decide our instant replay decision, you know, whether or not to roll back the call on the field, or maybe they could give call in a play. A reader suggested both Trump and Clinton should call a play during the action, which I love that idea.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay. His piece is called "Can We Mix the Debates and the NFL?" And his proposal is to just have the debate on the field during downtimes of the two NFL games where there are conflicts.
I mean, think of how interestingly and hilarious this is, Gordon, because here we are in 2016 with, you know, a very consequential presidential election, and it's going up against football. These debates, there are only three of them on the schedule so far.
And two of them are going up against football, and there's not like this feeling of, oh, well, we'll watch the debates. It's this universal feeling, oh, this is a problem because America is just that obsessed with football. It just shows the cultural grip this game has upon this country, and it's pretty undisputed at this point.
Thanks, Jason. Wall Street Journal sports writer Jason Gay merged the debates and NFL football. 6 minutes now in front of the hour. Good luck looking for serenity and sparse crowds at national parks this year. Some 300 million others are looking for the same thing. Often it's not so serene nor sparse. This year, as part of the great migration of tourists, the Wall Street Journal says Yosemite in California is expecting as many as 400,000 more people than last year's record-breaking crowd of 4.2 million. Even the first family caused what some call an Obama jam when they visited Yosemite in June. Overall, national parks had a record 307 million visitors in 2015, up 5% from the year before. That's just about a total of the U.S. population. Officials at the Grand Canyon say so many people are waiting in lines for shuttle buses, they can be 100 deep. They're using bus loaders to help coordinate, since it's worse waiting in that long line in Arizona heat. Those who escaped urban centers for America's wide open spaces now find themselves, the journal says, in longer than usual traffic jams, even epic bathroom lines. On the busiest days, how about this, in some of its bathroom stalls, the Grand Canyon is going through a mile of toilet paper a day. Per stall. A mile. Per day. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.